for a while, we're going to go back to basics, and we're going to kind of formalize a little bit of some discussions that we've been, at least at the informal level, talking about, mainly in the homework side or in the tutorial side. And you'll see why we need to introduce this in a second. So we're still thinking mainly that we're living on the hyperbolic front of things. And the reason we are kind of sticking to this problem is because we're going to be primarily interested in understanding dynamical situations governed by relativistic or general relativity or alternative theories of gravity, if you want, which typically tell us that the systems are governed by hyperbolic, and this has to do at some, at some deeper level of Lorentz invariance and the finite speed of propagation that information can should have. Later on, we'll say a little bit about elliptic equations, but we need to now be slightly more careful in how we distinguish different types of equations, because that will guide the techniques we use. In fact, the kind of things that we've been discussing in the past are all good for some subset of the hyperbolic equations, but all of them. So we started with what we discussed before. That would be perfectly applicable to general relativity, but it's not if you're coupled with matter sources, for instance, or if the matter sources obey some particular equations, but also to guide us in some of the coordinate choices that we may have. Remember, at the end of last week, we were discussing the freedom of choosing the lapse and the shift vector. We could come up with some clever options that may help, but we have to be mindful about some particular quirks that may be introduced by the type of equations that we may think about. And so it would be good if we can avoid these problems or features, and if we don't, then we should be aware of what type of implementation or numerical method we have to use in order to deal with these equations. So let me just start first a little bit on the formal level. The one good thing about the theories we're discussing is that they are of the type called quasi-linear. And by that we mean we can write things that have, and let me just put kind of a fictitious thing here, u, t equals some function of u, and this u, t, this u can be any vector, could be a single variable, could be a vector of variables. But the important thing is that this u, t comes clean. There's nothing that multiplies it with respect to the solution. We don't have things that look like this, like so. So as far as the time derivative is concerned, time derivative part is concerned, it just comes clean. So that's why they're called quasi-linear. Because they are almost linear. The nonlinearity is sitting in here rather than sitting on this part. Of course, there are some alternative theories of gravity that break that, but we're staying away from those for the time being. By the way, all the notes are posted, so you can get them from there. And I'm going through them today and tomorrow. So this is the type of equation we're thinking about. Further, we're thinking that this right-hand side can be written generically in terms of maybe some matrices. Sorry. This way. Let me change this to Q for the type of discussion we'll have coming. Q, T, a matrix Q, Xi. So if we imagine we're in three dimensions or in n dimensions, this will be n matrices that multiply the derivative of our variables in each of the different directions. And we have here plus lower order terms, which are anything that will have Q undifferentiated. And so this is referred to as the principal part of the system. And the reason we are interested in the principal part is that this is what determines propagation of perturbations. And we'll discuss in more detail later what we mean by this. OK, so we introduced already the concept of well-posedness. And rigorously, what we want to kind of establish in well-posedness is that suppose we have two types of initial configurations. Or two, for two different initial configurations. Let me just call that Q1 of x0 and Q2 of x0. And we have a sense that Q2 minus Q1 is a small quantity, delta. Well, posing this implies that the solution Q1 of x, t is less or equal to some e to some constant k times t power times some factor times, let me just say, Q1 of x0. So for a given initial data, let's say I'll pick the Q1 for concreteness, we can show that the solution at a later time, the norm of it will be bounded by the initial data, let's say, or the energy in the initial data, multiplied by something that is allowed to grow exponentially. But the important thing is that neither this guy nor that guy, they do not depend. On that guy. So we can bound the growth by looking at the system of equations themselves, and it doesn't depend on the initial data. And this has to do with, if this k, this constant, that govern how rapidly the solution can grow, were to depend on this, any little blip that we might put in the initial configuration will affect that, and it will keep going faster and faster. And using this observation, one can prove that Q1 of xt minus Q2 of xt in norm is going to be less than e to the kt, a times delta. And so this, in this sense, that we can say the good, one of the good things that we'll post is that we can always make this difference smaller and get a solution that will be approaching the R1. And uniqueness comes for free. If we take delta equal to 0, okay, then this one has to be equal to 0. And I mentioned in passing this example that you can get Maple to solve for you, which is considering, say, a Q being a vector of two unknowns. So I'm going to write like this. It's the following. The following problem, and the solution of this, say in Fourier modes, is equal to so here what it's telling us is that because this matrix is non-diagonizable, we can compute the eigenvector, the eigenvalues of this matrix, it's a 1. But it has a piece sitting in there which says that there is only one single eigenvector for this that corresponds to the eigenvalue 1. Then the solution, rather than describing something that propagates in time as x plus t, picks up this extra piece with a t factor in here. And that's bothersome, but this is also bothersome. So not only is it growing linearly with time, but it also depends on the frequency, the Fourier modes that may be in the initial data that we defined by Q omega zero. So this shows that it's cannot be tied that way. There is an extra piece that is growing like so. And the main problem for this is that if I were to add anything here, in particular, I can add that piece, the solution will now pick up an exponential e to the omega t here. And so generically, these are systems that are called weakly hyperbolic. Because the matrix, the principal, can't be diagonalized. So you can show that your system is such that the principal part cannot be diagonalized, then we're in trouble and we should either be looking on whether we're dealing with a physical problem. And if we are, we might have to see if there is some freedom, i.e. constraints in the system that we can bring in to kind of fix this problem in here. And we'll see later on in particular examples how that is done in some simple cases. Okay, so there is a distinction on the different types of hyperbolicity. So beyond weakly, there's something called symmetric, strongly, or strictly. We're not going to make such a big distinction. We just want to make sure the principal part can be indeed diagonalized, and in that case we'll be fine. So we know that in particular, if it can be diagonalized, then the original problem, let's say Q for a given vector, comma T, some given matrix, Q, comma X, let's imagine that we're in one dimensions, can be rewritten as some other problem. Let me just call it now, V, comma T, lambda 1, lambda n, v comma x, which means that now the problem can be reduced as a series of advection equations. And this is the best possible scenario. Well, posing this comes for free in the absence of boundaries. We can distinguish what modes will propagate in which direction, which will help us to define boundary conditions, but also allows us to distinguish the distinction or a further issue that we might encounter, which has to do with the topic of this week. We want to find, to understand what is the difference between that equation, say I have, say I pick one of these, and I just see there is Q comma T plus U. We are assuming that U is some smooth function that is a priori given, say, plus Q comma X equals 0, or these two equations are almost the same, except that in here I have a U, which, and remember this U is the velocity for this problem, that it shows something is propagating to the right with velocity U. This one is the same, it may propagate to the right, say if Q is positive, with velocity Q. So whenever we have an advection equation which we would get by assuming that we're dealing now with systems that are better than weakly hyperbolic, so they're strongly symmetric or strictly, and we see a variable that is determined by the advection equation, which is guaranteed by this condition, by this observation, and we see that the stuff that, or the function that multiplies the variable of interest is not itself, that system will be said to be linearly degenerate. So it's again, we're still dealing with a nonlinear equation because we have lower order terms in here, and Einstein's equations are like those, and hydrodynamics equations are nonlinear in that sense, but there is a very important difference between these. So this is, so GR sits in here. But if the velocity depends on the variable itself, this is called truly nonlinear. And say hydrodynamics sits in here. So now we want to understand why is that I'm taking a pause here, and I want to distinguish these two cases. And the reason for this is not very difficult. It has to do with the following. Let me just write it here. Remember, for the wave equation, we had this schematically what characteristics would be, and we found out that the word characteristics are propagated to the left, a constant speed equal to 1, and to the right, a constant speed equal to 1. If we have a linearly degenerate equation, say, and we're imagining that u is positive, we would have characteristics propagating to the right at velocities that may change depending on the value of u. So if we did draw a little pulse in here, it begins to move to the right, say with that velocity u, but when it gets to this region, it moves faster and faster because u is getting faster and faster like that. But if we have the second case, then the characteristics may still be moving to the right, but q determines the velocity. The solution itself is determining the velocity, and what typically will happen is one of two things. We might have characteristics crossing. Let's imagine that the velocity here, q, started with a larger value here. So we start with something that has this profile. So q is determining the velocity at that point. It's given by the value that we have in here. But to the right of it, q is smaller. That means the solution there is going to be moving at a slower speed. And so then these things will catch up. So this one is not moving as fast as that one, and at some point they will merge. And we have our first problem here, which is when characteristics cross, we want to physically understand what is the solution afterwards. But here we have a problem. Characteristics, by definition here, we said, okay, along this ray, the solution is determined is always equal to the value that it had here. But if we try to use that argument here, we would have one value up to here, but another value up to there, and then we need to understand what is the value afterwards. Of course, physically this doesn't happen. It's a consequence of using a particular set of equations to determine, for instance, the motion of fluids, which is just a realization of what nature is supposed to behave like, and then we have to live with this issue. So something has to happen in here to fix this issue, or if we're going to use numerically the problem, we're going to have to perhaps, and this is actually what we'll end up doing, introduce further conditions to determine what is the unique solution after these things happen. Alternatively, we can have something else. We can have, say, that this is a slower speed than that one, so our initial pulse begins to kind of diminish in strength in between, and this is called a fan, and this is called a shock. But we'll discuss this, and I'll show you some examples in not too long. So a typical example of this, without going to the hydrodynamics problems that we'll get to later, is something called the Berger's equation. Which is this. Or written a different way, of course. Thank you. So let me just do a detour, which will motivate how we're going to end up treating this kind of equation. So suppose we consider a little cell in here. So this is time and this is space. So the coordinates here is x1 and x2, and this may be time 1 and time 2. And we have a fluid density given by rho of x and t, and we want to define what is the mass contained in that box. And the fluid can be moving around, and we want to keep track of the mass. So the mass is just the integral between x1 and x2 of rho of x of t dx. Now let's see what happens. So as time, this might be the mass that we have in here, but as time progresses, mass can grow or diminish depending on what happens through the cells of the boundary. So we're going to be interested in the rate of change of mass. It will be d dt. And say we are evaluating this at some given time, in here, any arbitrary time. And the amount of mass that can come or exit this little box will be given by the fluid flow, the rate of fluid flow. So we can write this as rho x1 comma t times u. Say u is the velocity. Right, so here I just said this is, because we're taking positive going to the right, if the velocity is positive, this measures how much matter is coming from left into the box, and this one, how much mass might leave from the box out. And of course, if u changes sign, we get the right answer as well. So now, what we want to do is to iterate this in between time. Right, so what we have is the integral between x1 and x2 of rho x. So simply we're saying that the mass that we have at time t2 will be equal to the mass that we have at time t1 plus or minus whatever amount of matter flew in or out of the domain. So now I can change this, which is an integral equation, into a differential equation by simply bringing this piece to the left-hand side, divided by delta t, and equating signs. So let me just do it here. So if I define so with this, we can rewrite that last line over there by simply t1, t2, x1, x2. And this is just a continuity equation. Which is just a balance law for the rate of change of the density as dictated by gradients of fluxes that may be coming in or out of our domain of interest. Okay, so now let's say, well, we take this equation. And this is an equation, okay, let's guess this dt rho plus dx rho u equal to zero. And we want to see how we're going to iterate this equation that comes naturally from physical arguments and see what happens. So for that, I'm going to come back to this problem, to the problem up that we mentioned here. And we want to be able to say how we're going to iterate past these points when we actually started with some physical question over there, which was how do we find out what the mass is at a later time, given that we know what it is at initial time and how much fluxes go inside the box. So there's a problem in this and then trying to understand this equation as a result, or this equation as a result of the considerations here. And the problem is that in here, we made a big assumption that these changes can be written as a differential. This need not be the case because these kind of equations can have discontinuities. And if we can have discontinuities, it really doesn't make sense to take derivatives this way because we would have an infinity on the right-hand side when the left-hand side could be finite. And this is something we're going to have to reflect in whatever method we have. Just imagine numerically, we might have one of these shock fronts. It goes like that. And we have our grid extended this way, where these are points. If we try to take a derivative, say, based on this approximation, the point to the right and the point to the left, and we take h going to 0, the jump in of the function between these two points, it's always constant, and we're divided by something that gets smaller and smaller, so that the result of the derivative will be higher and higher, and we're going to have a problem. So we're going to have to come up with new techniques to deal with this problem. So the techniques we're going to get, we're going to introduce, basically reflect in saying, or have to do with saying, okay, we're going to penalize possible behavior like this in this equation, in something like, it's understood as in the weak sense. So we're not going to make sense of this equation as being equal to zero, but rather as when multiplied by some smooth function, for any smooth function that we can think, we're going to try to satisfy that equation, and that will inform us in how to deal with this, problem. And we're not going to get into the details of that. I'm going to tell you what the answers are, and we'll take it from there. For that, we're going to take a second detour and just discuss a simpler problem, which is a problem introduced by Riemann. Which is, suppose we have the Burgers equation. And we define our conditions such that Q, so our initial profile is Q of x at t equal to 0 is given by the following. So we set up an initial condition that is perfectly discontinuous. So it has a constant value equal to QL to the left, to the negative side of the real axis. and Q right to the positive side of the real axis. So we have essentially something like either this or vice versa, depending where we think of QL being greater than QR or vice versa. Yes? We're going to have to say, well, the derivative is discontinuous across this point. But first, we're just, let's look at this problem defined this way. Let's find out what the solution of this problem is. And from there, we're going to begin to build up the required intuition to come up with a discretization for that problem. But at the moment, let's just discuss what is the general solution to this problem for the two cases, left being greater than R or right being greater than left. So notice that this piece, so if I only think of the negative side of the real axis, the equation we have is just simply Q plus Q comma T plus QL Q comma X equals 0. And this QL is a constant. It's whatever we put in the initial data, right? So that's a perfect, we know what the solution of this is. This is a profile that moves to the right. I'm imagining that QL is positive, and same thing with R, right? So we're imagining, so then with this condition, we know that the stuff from the left will just propagate to the right at constant speed given by QL. The stuff at the right also propagates to the right at constant speed QR. So if I'm looking at the solution here is just a perfect constant, right? Because we're setting it to be a constant. So the only change will be in this vicinity where Q left is advancing, say, we're imagining first that QL is greater than QR. So this is kind of going over it and moving in onto the QR because this one is not moving as fast as that one. So this is the first case where the characteristic cross and the characteristic to the left is advancing over the characteristic to the right. The solution for this is known analytically. Is Q of X and T is equal to Q left So we know that way, way to the right, for very, very large x, we should have the solution QR. For very small x's, we should have Q left. But here I've introduced something else. So with solutions will be QL and QR still. But where the separatrix is governed by this function S. And S is defined to be it's given by this, where f is 1/2 q squared. Why is it that we define f this way? It's again, I'm going to take a pointer from this one. Notice that the flux was that piece inside the gradient. So this whatever comes differentiated, whatever combination we might have, that's the flux. That's a thing that when we iterate by parts, we just get cleanly as a contribution at each cell or at each boundary of our little domain. So for this case, for the Burgers equation, and this is the reason why I wrote it these two ways, we recognize that what we have in here is the derivative with respect to x of 1/2 q squared. So that's that flux. Yes? Right, so we're doing it in general. So we're, you're right. So I could evaluate what this is precisely for this case. But in general, we're going to be, once we come up with the scheme, the fluxes, you're going to see them coming in explicitly. But I mean, that's a good point. For this case, we can just say that q squared 1/2 q squared L minus q squared R use. That q squared minus a squared minus b squared is a plus b, simplify that, and then we'll just have this is equal to 1/2 q left plus qr for this particular case. Let me just discuss the R one. the other case. So if QR is greater than Q left, so we have the opposite case, then the solution is given by so this is the case where the right and the left, the right moves much faster than the left. So you, we begin to backweight the interior region. And this is the solution. It's identically equal to Q left for points left of QL times T. Then there is this weird X over T behavior and this R1. And this, the fact that we're dividing by T is just representative of what we said. We're essentially evacuating the interior region, so as time goes by, this gets smaller and smaller. So what do we do with this? We do the following. We're going to exploit all the observations to come up with some way of training this at the discrete level. So notice that again, this doesn't say that Einstein's equations are not nonlinear, because they are. But one particular thing that Einstein's equation has is that we know that perturbations will propagate at the speed of light. We're talking about a fluid. The propagations will depend on the particular state that the fluid might have at any given point. And that's a fundamental difference, that depending on what our background solution is for a fluid, perturbations will propagate at a completely different, will show completely different propagation behavior. But if we do the same thing for Einstein's equations, then everything propagates with light speed. Okay, so to come out with some scheme to iterate this equation, we're going to again think of our little box in here and the solutions we discussed over there. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to think that again that we have a grid. The grid has these points. And we want to resist at all costs the assumption that the solution is smooth. In what we discussed last week, we use explicitly the smoothness of the solution to come out with approximations for derivatives and so on. Here we already notice that if we have this case and we're trying to take smaller and smaller discretization length, their derivatives will diverge at shock fronts. So we want to understand things in a different way. So what we're going to say is that we're going to imagine that surrounding each point of interest, there is a little cell. We're imagining, for simplicity, that this is an equidistant grid, so the spacing in between all of this is the same. So let me imagine putting cell boundaries in between the points, just sitting in the middle. And we're going to promote whatever we think the solution is at this point to a constant that is over the whole cell. So if the value here is 3, we're going to imagine that the whole cell has a value which is going to be R, the term we're going to denote by Q. Say this is the point I. Qi, say at the level n, say this is the level n. We're going to promote the value that we would think we would have assigned, thinking of it in the finite difference point of view, as just an average of that. The reason we do that is that because if this value next to it is a different value, we're going to imagine that Again, this is Q I plus 1. And what we're beginning to shoot for is that problem, the Riemann problem. Now, I'm imagining Riemann, we defined, we know analytically what the solution is. We had a state to the left and a state to the right of that boundary. Our boundaries will be where these little interfaces are imagined to be. And we now have a Riemann problem here because I have one state of the solution here and a completely different state of the solution there. And we're never assuming that this could be continuous. So we're going to put these things together and imagine that we discretize the equation in the following way. First, let me write it down and I'll tell you what the solution, what the notation is. So this is, would be what is guiding us in how to discretize this equation. So we imagine that we have this equation, the derivative of q, the rate of change of q with respect to time, the fluxes that govern the change at maybe possible sources or sinks that we have in there due to nonlinearities. I mean, this is just going to be an evaluation. So this is, in our mind, we have this, which is a continuous equation, but we know that we could have these continuities, and as such, we're going to regard this as a collection of isolated problems in each of these cells, and we're going to live with the possible discontinuities as pertaining to the interfaces themselves, just as the problem, the Riemann problem. So we're going to kind of put all the discontinuities in the interfaces, at the interfaces. So we're picturing, say, this is the level n. This is the level n plus 1. These guys in here, C sub I, n plus 1 half, are these cells. So we're calling this the Ci cell, which would be, because it's between level n and n plus 1, we're going to imagine the center is at n plus half. So that's our notation. And V of C I n plus a half is the volume that is in that cells. In the cells as thinking in our grid. So this will be delta T delta X. In this case, if we're dealing with three dimensions, it will be delta T delta X cube. And so now we discretize this, and what we get is simply the following. And we're thinking that we're discretizing across this interface, right? So I have to the left the value q sub n I. I have to the right a value q sub n I plus, for half, plus 1. And so now the derivative will give us sorry, I'm thinking about this cell, the cell I. So I have the value, well, here will be q sub n plus 1. And this would be q bar n I. So I have my, the value of q change from here to there in this way. And it changed due to fluxes across either this interface or that interface. That we're going to write as, sorry. Where Okay, so these are all the pieces. So first, we're defining, as we said, the Q bars to be the average that Q may have within the cell at either this time or that time. The Fs are the fluxes evaluated at the left cell or the right cell. And this phi is the average of the source of the sink over the volume of interest. So notice the following. In this term, for instance, in principle, one could be tempted of using this, but we have a problem because this flux here needs to know the solution, right? Because what we're doing is we're approximating how much stuff might cross this cell boundary or that cell boundary, which requires knowing what the solution is through time. So in principle, what one could do is just iterate this in time, just as we did with Krang-Nicholson. You put the old value and you keep iterating. So we're going to have to iterate no matter what to obtain the contributions of the fluxes. So given that we're going to have to do that anyways, there is a simpler method that was introduced by Roy based on things that Godunov, I mean the theory that Godunov introduced, which will be simpler for us. So I'll just give you the recipe and I'll show you some examples, and we're going to get into this in more detail tomorrow. So let me stress the things we did. So we motivated the equation we have to deal and the issues we're going to have to face with the simple example of trying to account for the matter within a cell for a fluid distribution, say. We then did a kind of a side remark on what this particular Riemann problem, the solution to the Riemann problem is, and we recognized two possible cases, assuming a very, very simple situation where we had a particular state of the system to the left of some interface that was exactly constant and to the right that was exactly constant. And we're able to write explicitly what the analytical solution to that problem is. And then taking a page of this and the problems we raised there, we said, well, because we cannot assume continuity, we're going to assume that we have in our grid these kind of cells that are defining between grid points. And we're going to reinterpret the problems on each cell as being just constant problems, which then brings us back to the Riemann, the Riemann problem we discussed before, and that's what we're taking advantage of. Once we took that route, we ended up being able to write something that at least would be in principle correct. It would account for the fact that things can be discontinuous, but then it gave us something we cannot evaluate exactly because we don't know the solution yet, and then we're gonna have to approximate it. And then solving this problem approximately can be done, but there is a simpler method, which is the one we're going to use, that picks up on essentially all the pieces that we have been building up in a much more expeditious way. So this Roy solver is an approximate solution to the sequence of Riemann problems that we would have had with that, which we had to approximate anyways, and so this one particular way. So for the key ingredient of the Roy solver is the following. So you start with this equation. And let me assume that we don't have any source, because the source just adds a contribution or not. We're going to rethink this problem as being given by this. The only thing, so we're just using the Jacobian to re-express the derivative of the fluxes with respect to the space, because it's going to be easier for us. Remember, our basic variable is the Q that live on these grids, and we have the values of these cells. So it's going to be easier for us to account for the changes in Q than changes in the fluxes. And so we're going to say, we're going to evaluate the fluxes, how the fluxes depend on the variable Q themselves, and then multiply by the rate of changes of these Qs. We need a recipe then to express what the fluxes are, what the jumps in the Qs will be, and let me just give, and also account for possible jumps of variables. So let me just say the following. The other thing we need to, well, one thing I need to say is the following. So we need to evaluate the Qs. The Qs were, and we're thinking that Q is a constant in here. We have taken the average to represent what the value of Q would be inside that cell. But we also want to be mindful that things are the dynamics and they are moving. So while we might have the value of Q here at this level, which is the one we're going to use to update for the next one, here we're trying to evaluate things in between all the boundaries of the cell. So we're going to approximate it by the value that it has at the middle. So somehow we need to account for the fact that even though we know the time here, we don't know what the solution is half a time step above. So we're going to introduce a slight correction to that. And we also want to be mindful that things can be discontinuous and propagated in a complicated way. So we're going to define the following. We're going to say the flux, and this I'm going to put for the time being rho, because this is one option for approximating the flux. I'd say the cell interface I plus a half, which we need to because it's showing up there, it's going to be the following. It's going to be 1/2 of the flux evaluated, and let me just first write this down. So we need, once more, to account for the flux that will be, say, at this interface. We could have fluxes coming into way. We can have things that come from this cell onto the R1, so leaving our little cell, or from this cell into this one, and therefore accounting for some extra contribution of, say, matter into that cell. And that we will do it in two ways, well, by considering two contributions. This one is the, and I'll tell you what there is at 12 in a second, is the value of, and it should, I don't know why it's P, it should be Q, but it's the way it's in the notes with P. So this would be an approximation of what this right cell contribution would be right at the interface, right at the middle time level. This one is an approximation of the flux that is coming from the left to that right, to that middle point level. And we're going to introduce a little bit an extra term here. So this is just the fluxes. We're going to introduce something else. Again, we'll see this in more detail tomorrow. Here we're adding a little extra piece, and this extra piece is to account for the possible jump in discontinuity that the variables will have. And you'll see why this comes in here, but it's related to the fact that the velocity of propagation of the flux, of the discontinuity needs to know what the flux is, and also the fan that may open up if the fluid velocities are in the opposite direction due to the fact of the discontinuity. So this will allow us to that. And in addition to that, it adds a little bit of dissipation if the jump is too high. And the other thing we need to say is the following. I haven't told you why we have put tildes here. The tildes will be the following. So I'm going to define Q tilde, say R I plus a half is equal to Q tilde Q average i plus 1. So again, this stands for the value that the interface to the right of the one of interest is defining right there at the middle time. So at the right, we have the value of Q at the right cell. That's Qi plus 1. So I need to kind of bring this information into here and account for the fact that things might change with time. So this is Qi plus 1/2. Plus sigma I plus half minus x I plus 1. So notice that what we're doing, we're just saying the value at I plus half is whatever we have to the right plus some little bit of correction, which we have to account because we're seeing something. Say I'm interested in this interface, and I have this value and that value formally centered there. So I need to recenter it here, both in time and space. So this is the little correction. This is the amount of space in between that point and the interface point. And this sigma I is a useful thing to introduce to account for possible big jumps. And I'll define here what it is. It's a function that was introduced with the following. So let me just go by slowly. So sigma I will tell us, so how would you extrapolate information from here onto there? You'll say, well, it could be the value that I have in here plus the distance plus some slope, right? The rate of, so if I have, say, this function, and I have these two points, and I want to obtain what the value would be, an approximation to the value there, I can say, well, it's going to be the value here plus the slope that I have in here plus this delta this, just using Taylor, right? But we want to be mindful that things are maybe discontinuous. So first, I say, I want to incorporate what is a given slope. So I'm going to define a slope in the particular way that we'll know what the slope is to the right and to the left of the points of interest. So that's why I have the si minus 1/2 and si plus 1/2. So I'm going to calculate the slope here and a slope there. And depending on what I do, what I get, I'm going to do different things. So let me just tell you what these things are here. This is probably the messiest part of this, but it's actually very crucial. So I'm defining si plus 1/2 as q bar I plus 1 minus q I bar divided by x I plus 1 minus x I. So this is just the slope in between here and there. That's what comes in here, right? This I plus 1 and I. But when I do I minus 1/2, what I'm looking is at the slope between this cell and the cell to the left. So this is the mean mod is the cell to the left of the interest, the cell to the right of interest, we can compute the slope. And then we do something with it. And this is this function mean mod. Mean mod of two slopes, A and B, will be equal to 0 if A times b is less than 0. So what we're saying is that if the slope, so if I have this, so this is the point of interest, this is the cell to the right, this cell to the left. If, say, the slope I would compute in between the two of them, say this like that, and this like this, so I have something that is beginning to develop a kink, right? Because then otherwise it would pick up this kind of behavior. I don't like that. That's what the scheme says. The solutions are supposed to be smooth. So if the slope is such that to the left and to the right are negative, then I'm going to just say it's 0. I'm going to do, this is telling me that a shock is developing. Across the shock, things are constant before and after. And so I don't want to extrapolate because I would be extrapolating information that is discontinuous and this simple assumption of smoothness wouldn't apply. And in addition to that, you're going to say is the following. So this is what this is. This means, so suppose this does not happen. We don't have two different slopes. We have the both slopes go in the same direction. So we're either on one side of the shock or on the other side of the shock. We're not across the shock. And then we don't want to make we want to take the most conservative approach. And we said of the two slopes, if they have the same sign, just take the smallest one. So this is called a slope limiter approach. And tomorrow I'll discuss more about this, but let me just show you some examples so that we kind of see why we have to worry about these things in a real application. And so what we're doing again is just a Riemann problem for the Berger's equation. We know what the solution should be. We think we know. And I'll show you if this comes up. Yeah. So let me first show you. Let's see. Okay, so let me just first show the Riemann shock problem for this scenario. So the fluid is going to be moving faster at the right than it is moving to the left. Sorry, to the left than to the right. And this is what you have. So we have this very sharp step function moving to the right with the particular speed that we discussed. Suppose we had the other case where we have like this. This is that fan that we discussed. You see, the thing to the right is moving way faster than the thing to the left. We develop this kind of straight function in x, which decays in time. Okay, so we discussed a few options. So we could have done this one. We could have also, you say, well, wait a minute, I know how to take derivatives. So why don't I do this? And I said, well, we actually worked hard enough last week to define different ways of discretizing this equation. Let me just as well try them to see how it would behave. We're going to be slightly smarter. We'll say, well, we know these things are moving to the right. And we're going to use something that is called an upwind method, which basically says if you know things have moved to the right and you're trying to obtain the value of the solution here, just use derivative to the left. This is stable. If we actually use derivative to the right and we don't do a better treatment in time, this is unstable. So we're going to just compare to this one. I'm going to compare either this case or a case where I add a third point on the previous level to do a higher accuracy thing. So here, we only do a first order accurate approximation to the derivative there. And with three, I can do a second order accurate. And let's compare all of them. So the first thing I'm going to show you is this one. Right. I want this one. Yeah, so this is, we're thinking about a different case. A different initial case, but the point is the same. So this is, we're imagining initially a pulse profile that has that profile and want to know what happens afterwards. Again, if you think for a moment, this little piece of the solution will be moving at a slower rate than this piece of the solution. So we expect a shock to be developing in this case. And on the other side, we expect a fan because this piece moves faster than that piece, right? So we have both discussions to the right and to the left. So this is what I'm going to do. This case, so I'm not taking into account that the flux is really 1/2 q squared. I just did q, qx. And so to discretize this, we're using for time derivative these two points. To evaluate this q, I evaluate the value that I have in there. And to evaluate the derivative, I use this point and that point. So that's our stencil, and that's what we do. And we can see that we get something that is really crappy. So we're not doing too badly on the fan case, on the fan region, but the front is completely inaccurate. So it's not only bad in amplitude, it's also bad in the velocity at which it marches. And this is a case where if we try to put more resolution, things will get worse and worse because of the discontinuities that we're encountering. So let me just do the same thing. But now we're going to try to be slightly better and say, well, I'm going to do that. And so here, again, we do the time derivative between these 2 points. And the space, we evaluate 1/2 q squared here, 1/2 q squared there, and we take the difference. Oh, wait, let me show you this one first. So now notice how much better this problem does. We're slightly off, but it's not too bad. And the only thing we did is to change 1/2 q squared. I mean, we're using 1/2 q squared for the derivative instead of q times the gradient. The reason we're now doing better is that now when we take the before, when we have the q, comma t plus q, q, comma x, we were assuming that q was a good approximation to how fast this fluid was moving. And of course, if we have something that is discontinuous, we're going to be picked, we're assuming that the velocity was this one when the velocity was something slower than that. Actually, sorry, faster, because we have faster and slower. And so we're underestimating the velocity at which it has to move. So let's say we're not too happy with the differences, so let's do better, I think we try to do better. Let's add another point here and do a second order approximation of the derivative here of the flux, and this is what we get. So now it's far better, but we pay the price. We pay a price that we're completely screwing up here. And again, this has to do with the fact that we're assuming, whenever we're taking these more points, that the finite difference approximation can do well, because implicitly we're assuming the solution is smooth, when it's definitely not. And so let's see, let me show you this one. This is again the two different cases we discussed first, but with, here we have for the shock case, this is in blue is the exact solution. So it's, sorry, in red is the exact solution, in blue this is numerical solution. So this, the numerical scheme that we have is doing very well there. And let me show you the fan. Again, there is a slight difference at the very top and the bottom, but the solution is very well captured. And this was for the previous solution, what the analytical solution is. So this is what we were trying to obtain. And all the schemes that we tried do not work, but the scheme that we are beginning to discuss, we'll see that it does quite excellently. And so what the first lab is going to be, I'm not going to be at the tutorial today, because I have to do, have to go to Guelph, but what the first lab is going to be
exercise where you go and attach things slightly here and there, but then our goal would be to get this thing right, which is relativistic hydrodynamics. And so this is actually showing the pressure of a given fluid that is expanding in a particular way and solving all of the relativistic hydro equations that you get from the inputs. So I suggest that, well, I try to wrap the stuff from the previous lab if you can today. I'd be here tomorrow morning. If you have questions, you can always come see me. And tomorrow we'll try to discuss this problem in more detail and get you going.